Hello, this is the Reverend Timothy Farthing, Vicar of Warmington-on-Sea, bringing you Christmas greetings. And it is lovely to be talking to you, and I hope you have a very happy Christmas. Frank Williams, signing off. Bye-bye.
Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think we're on the run?
Hello and welcome to episode 55 of the Dad's Army podcast. And as it's such a special podcast for a number of reasons, we thought we'd try and get in the mood and go and sit in the middle of a London park, drinking hot drinks and recording this intro.
Yeah, we're getting him a Christmassy feel. I mean, are they sleigh bells ringing?
Sleigh bells? I think it might be.
Goodness me.
Sleigh bells in St. James's Park.
This
How strange.
Absolutely fantastic.
Amazing. Well, as I said before, we've got a rather special show for you today. We're going to bring you an interview with none other than Mr. Bill Pertwee.
That's absolutely brilliant. Is this the first full-length interview Bill has done with the Dad's Army podcast?
It is indeed, and rather regrettably, it wasn't you or I who interviewed him.
No, it's true. We have to give credit and huge thanks to the legend that is Paul Carpenter from the Dad's Army Appreciation Society, who very kindly went all the way to Devon to see Bill to get us and you this exclusive interview. And the great thing about it is that Bill doesn't just talk about Dad's Army, he talks about life in general. I certainly have learnt a lot about Bill from this interview, and I'm sure you'll find it a very enjoyable interview.
Absolutely. Before we play that interview, Oliver, I want to ask you a question.
Okay.
And of course, this is completely unplanned here, so this is Oliver's natural reaction. Do you have a particular favourite Hodges moment?
Hodges moment?
Hmm.
I don't know if it's a favourite Hodges moment. I think it's the bravest in terms of Bill, when Bill actually is drunk on the pier and he stands in his pants. I think it's quite a bit of bravery there. I mean, you know, Bill Pertwee was never Arnold Schwarzenegger, but he lets it all hang out and goes for it, you know. And I've always admired him for that. And I think, in fairness, it's a great Hodges episode, actually. Was it Menace from the Deep?
It is Menace from the Deep.
I got a title right. It's Christmas.
Brilliant.
I got a title right.
Well, it must happen once a year.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's a fantastic climax to that episode with Rod Wilson. He is a good bowler. off the cuff, that would be my favourite Hodges moment.
I have to say, I'm a little surprised that Bill Pertwee in his underwear is your favourite moment, but, you know, it takes all sorts. I think mine is the very end of Two and a Half Feathers. Hmm. And the reason for that is because there's a kind of unique piece of comedy there. Within the flashback sequence for Jones's, you know,
on the desert.
That's right, experience in the desert. Hodges, or Pertwee, plays one of the villains.
One of the
desert,
bandits.
You know, warlords. Yeah, bandits, that's it, absolutely. Who really hates fire.
Yeah.
And every time he sees fire, his nose goes.
Yeah.
You know, and yet, he does exactly the same expression at the end of the episode when it's actually set in wartime. Yeah, it's a weird kind of comedic moment because he's making us laugh, not the characters, by raising his eyebrows and screwing up his nose again. So that's one particular one that I really, really enjoy. And of course, in a way, the perennial episode, and not many people will like this example, but I thoroughly enjoy Pertwee in Never Too Old, where he really puts the boot into the Home Guard at the end of the episode by saying, well, they go through you like a dose of salts, you know.
Yeah.
You're not real soldiers. Because that epitomises everything that the Hodges character was created to achieve, which was continually keep the Home Guard on their toes, fighting with people who are on the same side of them, at least in terms of war anyway. And it's a really straight, serious, nasty scene, really.
It is.
That's basically stolen by Bill Pertwee.
And also the fact that, you know, the series, whilst that didn't go on, at the time they're in, the war did go on, you know, and we had to think that these things continued and to have a nice... And I suppose they didn't really know until poor Teddy Sinclair died that they wouldn't do any more. But it certainly is a very... it's a very strong finale to a sitcom, much like Blackadder Goes Forth when they go out into out of the trenches. Was an amazingly moving moment. I think having the surviving members of the platoon toast Britain's Home Guard. Yeah, you're right. It is a very special Bill Pertwee moment. And I, for one, and I bet you at home can't wait either, to listen to what Bill has to say about his fantastic career.
So, without any further ado, let's do just that.
Hello everyone, this is Philip Murdoch speaking. I do wish you all a very Merry Christmas. On behalf of the Ads Army podcast, he's wishing you a very Merry Christmas.
Hello everyone, this is the Dad's Army podcast, and this is a very special interview today. And with me is none other than Bill Pertwee, writer, broadcaster, actor, well, you're a member of the British Empire as well. I'd just like to welcome Bill. But to start off with, as you probably know, Bill, they've just released It Sticks Out Half a Mile on CD now. And that was done in the 1980s, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
And are you surprised it's come out on...
Well, I am, really, because it was going to star Arthur Lowe with John the Measurer, and Arthur Lowe... after they'd done the pilot. So they did another pilot, and it was written by Harold Snowden and Michael Knowles. So they asked me whether I would come into it, so that John the Measurer sort of moved up one peg, as it were.
That's right.
And I sort of then came into it as this extra person. I didn't think it was the... I mean, it was okay. So there was a lot of names in it, but I'm not sure that that's a good thing to rely on. The writing, I don't think, was the greatest, because they were doing it in a hurry, and you can't do something in a hurry. You've got to think about it. But once the BBC had given them the all clear to go ahead and do the series without Arthur, and they didn't give them much time, and that's always a bad thing.
Did they approach you after they'd done the pilot and said, oh, we want to rewrite it, are you interested?
After they'd done the first pilot, yes, they asked me whether I'd like to join them, which was a good cast anyway. And so I said, of course, you know, that's very nice, thank you very much.
I must say I was ever so surprised to hear from you again, of all people.
Ah, it's just a friendly gesture. Your gestures weren't very friendly in the Home Guard days. When you were the Chief Warden, Captain Mannering used to say that he couldn't make up his mind who he hated the most, you or Herr Hitler.
He always did have a sense of humour.
I don't think he was joking. I don't think he liked you at all. Especially when you used to call him Napoleon and the rest of us hooligans.
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah. How long is it now?
How long is what now?
How long is it since those days at Warmington?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. Well, war's been over nearly 3 years now, hasn't it?
There you are, then. That's all in the past. Here, you sure you don't want anything stronger than that orange squash?
The first question, that's where were you born?
Amersham.
Senior school. What senior school did you go to?
I didn't until I was about 14, I think, to this small school when I was evacuated. Yes, because there were so many people coming away, children, that you had to try and find your own accommodation if possible. So I had an aunt in Storrington, so I went to stay with her in Sussex, and that was the first time that I'd sort of met this very eccentric master. He was a French bloke, come into school with plus fours, different coloured socks, and a cap he'd turn around the wrong way. Very eccentric, but I took to him straight away. He sort of started me off. He said, oh, I know you can't really read and write, but never mind, we'll sort something out. I think I was 13, just past 13, I'm not sure. Anyway, and he was a lovely bloke. He made me come out of myself, as it were. And he did say to him once, he said, I think you keep picking up bits of wood and looking at them and so forth. Do you find? Are you keen on woodwork? I said, oh, I'd like to be. So he said, well, I tell you what, I do lino cuts, and I press them out, and the picture comes up, because I do them in various colours. So he said, would you like to have a go at it? So I said, oh, yes. So I did, and he said, no, that's quite nice. You've done a nice job there. I tell you what, he said, we'll do some. And that was near Christmas. He said, we'll take them down the village and sell them. He said, like a Christmas card. So I said, oh, okay. And he said, we'll sell them for tuppence each, and I'll take a halfpenny.
All right, so make something out of it.
Yes. And we sold out down there. But a lovely old lady had a smashing, real old-fashioned cafe, and we went in there and sold several in there, and then stood outside and sold the rest. And that was the beginning. And after that, I thought, I must think about this. Perhaps my career, I'd like to be making money.
Well, making money, yes. Because anything. Also, when you were at school, did you do any stage plays? Were you involved in any plays at school?
Only one for this gentleman. They had only had very few lines, very few. And I came on stage and I couldn't remember them at all. Just looked at the audience. So he said, come on, fuck. They said, come on. So I did, and that was the end of my career on stage.
So when did you decide to go into acting, and who helped you do this?
Yes, I hadn't met my cousin, John. This was after the war. I knew that he used to do recordings down at the Paris Cinema in Regent Street. She had I forget the name of the show now, but it was very popular, and he played this Devon fellow, Waterlogspa. He taught it like that all the time, because it's supposed to be in Devon accent. Mm. And I was mesmerised by this, I thought it was lovely, and we got together. He was living then in just the other side of Kensington, and I was living by that time in London with my brother and my mother, because my elder brother had died early in the war. And it was extraordinary, because I'd met John and met him after the broadcast that I went to see, and he said, oh, you must come, we have a get-together every now and again, a little party, a few friends. Well, I said, thank you very much, I'd love to. And I did, and at that party was Beryl Reid, well-known comedian. I didn't drink there, except that he said, well, you must have a little something. So I had a sort of a very small glass of beer. And that sort of gave me, I suppose, a bit of Dutch courage, yes. Yeah. So, because she was then talking to John about getting some material together for a small review in London to work out the material for a television series he had coming up. And I, in my stupidity, went up and said to her, when she'd stopped talking to John, between said, I could write some lovely things for you. I'm sure they'd be very fun. She said, oh, that's marvellous. It's marvellous. Well, there you are. There's the telephone number of the producer. I said, oh, well, thank you. Just tell him that you can do this. So I did. And he said, oh, I'd like to see them, please. And he rang me back. He said, well, that's marvellous. And you'll get £3 a week.
Crikey,
for us using the material. So three small sketches. I thought, wow, this is something for that. I think that by that time I was window cleaning in London. I was a window cleaner in London for about 5 years. Mm. And it was quite extraordinary, because on there, I think it was, they were supposed to open on a Tuesday, this review in London, for a few weeks. He rang me and he said, one of the chaps who would be sort of working with Beryl has got flu and he can't talk. So he said, I wonder if, because you know the words, whether you'd like to come in and do it. Well, I didn't do this sort of thing.
That never happened these days, would it?
So I said, well, yes, all right. When do you start? He said, Tuesday. And I said, what time? He said, we're starting at 8 o'clock. I said, well, I'll pop in about 7:30. Is that all right? He said, got to rehearse. Because these sketches are not just with Beryl alone. They're with other people. I said, oh, dear. Well, I said, I get up early in the morning for the window cleaning. And I have a break after lunch. I'm finished about 3. So I said, I suppose, you know, I generally have a sit down and a bit of a nod off. Then so he said, well, if you could possibly get together before that. I said, well, I've only got Sunday. So he said, well, we'll try and arrange something. So I said, okay, fine. So we did, and didn't seem very, very difficult to me. All. And he said, you're not nervous, are you? I said, no, I don't know. Do people get nervous? So he said, well, yes, actors do. I said, well, yes, well, I'm not really an actor, am I? So he said, all right, well, we'll do that. And then perhaps you could sort of come a bit earlier on the Tuesday when we start. So I said, oh, yeah, I'm sure I can. So I got there at, I don't know, about 5:30, I think it was. And we went, had a quick run through of what was happening. And then the show started at 8 o'clock. And I remember with a lovely fellow I was dressing with, two fellas, one who eventually became quite a big noise in broadcasting, and the other one was Ivan Novello's, his understudy, when his shows went on tour. And so I saw them sitting, I was sitting there, and I saw them make up, you know, and I said, oh, I haven't got any of that. He said, oh, borrow mine. So I did. Well, I started to plaster my face all over. It was horrendous. I looked in the mirror, and he said, oh, my God, I'll do it. Rubbed all that off, and he did it for me, and I said, oh, thank you very much. Right, well, so we were sitting there waiting for the opening, as it were, and I started to whistle. And he said, oh, my God. And he took hold of me, took me outside and turned me around 3 times.
Around 3 times.
And he said, God, you mustn't whistle. I said, oh, do you do this every night? Only if you're whistling. I said, oh, I'll remember that. went back and the show went fine. Made one or two friends there, apart from Beryl, of course, who I'd met before. And that was really a sort of start, I suppose.
Sort of start by accident, really, wasn't it?
I suppose so, yes.
When you did start out, did you have any once you got into it, or did you have any ambitions once you started?
Well, no, I didn't, but I gave up the, as I say, gave up window cleaning after this thing, and John Pertwee was going out on tour, because he was then a big name from radio in Variety, and he said, I wouldn't mind you coming with me and sort of helping me and so forth. So I said, all right, do I get any money? So he said, I'll give you £5 a week and your accommodation, because I have a big caravan. So that's how we started, went round, and I quite liked this idea of, you know, quite a lot of pretty girls around and so forth, and dancers, etc.
Got on tour as well, you say?
Yes, we toured around, and it was pretty amazing. And we got back. We got back to London. I thought I might have a go at this, and so I rang up John and I said, "I'm going to have a go at your game." I said, "I rather fancy it." So he said, "Don't be silly." He said, "You don't know anything about it, really. No, you give the family a bad name." I said, "Oh well." He said, "If you insist," he said, "you want to walk up and down Charing Cross Road, London, and stand outside the Express Dairy where all the agents have their morning coffee." So I did, and he said, just say that, you know, he said, just put your hand up that you're free, as it were. And some chap came out who had an office in Covent Garden, and he said, I think I could probably do something for you. So I said, oh, thank you. He said, can I see your work? So I said, well, yes, Concert Artists Association, because I've just joined them. And I said, it's, you know, I haven't really got a solo performance. He said, well, don't worry about that. He said, you just want to see you working with other people. So he did. And that's really the start of it. What I did was I did a little sketch on my own of various people playing cricket.
This one you wrote yourself, you said?
Yes. And so I did it there. And it was, well, under small circumstances, I nearly knocked the head off the pianist, who I didn't have to use because I was flaying this cricket bat around. I said, you know, here we are now, we've got this sergeant major playing cricket, and that went up on the shoulder like a sergeant major might do, and all this sort of thing. And then I did about three characters. This fellow said, yes, I said, if you just leave it with me, I think I could do something. And he came back to me and he said, now there are two options. They want somebody at Morecambe as a second comedian, so he'd be sort of principal comedian you'd be working with, and also at Galston near Yarmouth.
All right.
So I said, oh, well, I have an aunt who, she was called her auntie, but she was actually a cousin, to stay with her. But if not, she'll find me somewhere. So he said, all right, fine. He said, well, I think you probably will pay will be about £9 a week. I said,
quite going up slowly.
Oh, yes, I said, oh, I couldn't do it. I said, I'd have to have £10 because, I mean, you know, so it's all, I mean, there's a lot of work to do, isn't there? So he said, I'll see what I can do. Came back, he said, well, the management is also the singer in the show, Galston. There are only seven of us, including a pianist. And he said he can only afford £9. So I said, oh, well, I'll probably have to take it then. Yes, so I did. And, oh, well, I worked with this lovely comedian, taught me a lot, really. Lovely fellow. Eventually, much, much later on, I got him a part in Dad's Army, small part.
Right.
He was absolutely thrilled to bits. Oh. And that was it. But after a fortnight, one of his girls, who was principal dancer and singer, and was doing the sort of stage production for him. So she called him together in front of me and said, listen, this fella you've got here, Pertwee, said he can't tell a joke, he can't sing, and he can't dance. He'll have to go. He said, well, I never get anybody else this time of year. They're all already in summer shows. And besides, you know, it wouldn't get anybody so cheap anyway. So he'd have to stay. She walked away with the principal comedian and said, well, we're really lumbered, aren't we? We'll have to teach him in some way, which they did between them and so forth. So that was my first really entry into being a solo performer.
Oh, right.
Well, I did, after that summer season finished, I went away in Variety for a few weeks. Then I got a call from this lady who was going out in Variety, but she needed a partner, and would I like to join her? So I said, well, yes, what's the money like? So she said, well, it won't be too bad. She said, I've got a few dates already lined up. One was in, I don't know, Torquay. Another one was right up in the north somewhere, about three dates. So we started off. Well, I didn't do terribly well because I'd got together a couple of spots then, little spots, with impressions. Mm. Went up to the, Bournemouth, we were going to play Bournemouth as well. Went up to Newcastle area. We played up there, and they couldn't understand, because I was doing impressions of Noel Coward and Jack Buchanan.
Oh, it was all alien to them, was it?
They had never heard of them. So they sat there with absolutely no reaction at all in the audience. And the MD, who was a small orchestra they had, he went to sleep, and I used to have to kick what's going to wake him up to play the music and pay him off, which we did. So that didn't last too long, but we kept together and did one or two cabaret shows, which was quite nice and easy to do. Well, I found them easy, and eventually she and I got married. That was, so that was quite something.
That was Marion.
That's right, yeah. And then it just went on from there. And luckily, I had at the end of the summer show to Galston, BBC used to do songs from the seaside every week. The fellow who was producing it had been talking to Charlie Chester and Tommy Trinder, who were in the main show in Yarmouth, and I used to, funny enough, play tennis with Tommy's wife.
They were big names then, weren't they?
Yeah, they were huge names, yes. And they said, we want a 4-minute opening spot. And so both of them said straight away, go down to Galston and see this fellow called Pertwee. He does a few impressions and so forth, and we've heard he's quite good. So he came down and saw me and said, I'm going to suggest that you join us for one of our seaside shows, and it may be in Yarmouth here. So I said, oh, well, okay, that'd be nice. Mm. Worked out well. Then a producer had heard it in London and asked me to come up and see him when I'd finished whatever I was doing then. So I did, and at that time, it was Beryl Reid's husband who was producing Midday Music Hall, mm-hmm. and he gave me a spot, an opening spot on that, and that was the start of my radio career, really. From then, I joined Charlie Cheston, Max Miller, and all sorts of people, and Cyril Fletcher, I remember. So I'd suddenly become sort of stuck on radio there. I loved it, and there we go. That was the start. And from that, I went into Beyond Our Ken, because they'd done 6 programs, and they wanted to slim everything down. Mm. So they wanted a sort of utility man in the show.
Jack of all trades, also for different voices.
Yeah, that's it. And so that was fine. It was, yes, 2 people left, and I sort of took over as that utility man, which was lovely.
And that led on to
Round the Horn.
What was Kenneth Williams like to work with? Because everyone seems to be fascinated by him, don't they?
Yes, well, I think that Kenny Williams, he had 2 sides to him. I mean, he was a very funny bloke at these broadcasts. He used to make the audience, as soon as he was introduced, as we all were, by the producer before we started, and he used to get a few laughs straight away, you know, over some experience he'd had, which is funny. And also Kenneth Horne, who I thought was a great master of the microphone, he really was. When we were arriving in the morning at the studios in Lower Regent Street, the Paris studios, first of all, it would be Kenneth Williams sort of telling us what had been going on. And I remember one occasion, he said, you know, I mean, it's so difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, I've had this awful ball on my bum. So Kenneth Horne said, oh dear, I'm sorry to hear that. When did this happen? About a month ago. Yes. I see. So, and he said, you know, this morning, there it was. He said, what, the same ball that you had on your bum 1 month ago? All this going on. So we started off in a very good sort of mood, as it were.
I suppose with radio, what we obviously listeners don't see is his visual antics, which must have gone on.
Absolutely. That was one of the great things. If you sort of fed, and certainly Ken would say, well, I was very, very good, yes. But I don't think we're not hearing more about balls at the moment. Don't dismiss it, because that's very painful. All this used to go on. And that Barry Took and Eric Merriman were writing then, and they'd written 6 Beyond Our Kens, and they, as I say, they wanted a utility man to go in, which I did. Then there was some, not quite sure what happened, but Beyond Our Ken finished around about 1963, 64. and we were sort of taken to the radio department in the Aeolian Hall, Bond Street, and said that we would be going on, but the title would be different and the writers would be different. It would be Barry Took again, almost certainly, with another chap, or
Marty Feldman.
Marty Feldman, that's it. And, well, it went on for some time. I mean, it was fine, except that I think that they were coming up to do... They said, oh, we'll see whether we do another series or not, but they're not sure they were going to. Okay, fine. Well, then I got a letter from this producer and said, thank you for your help in the series, but we won't need your services.
Oh.
We are going to do another 6 or 7 programme. That was it, yours sincerely.
Oh, that's...
So I'd got the boot, as it were, but didn't really mind because I had fixed about on and off 2 years at the Windmill.
And you also did summer season as well, weren't you?
That's right. Well. Did a summer season in Bognor. And then we were going to do another one. That was 1968. And the people came up from Plymouth and said, oh, we've seen your shows here. We'd like to take the whole thing, lock, stock and barrel, down to Plymouth for the season. It'd be about 5 months. So everybody said, wow, oh, marvellous. And so we all go down there. They put me up in a small hotel. I was with Marion. She came down with me. And it was quite extraordinary because they got so excited and so forth. I said, well, I must think about it, but thank you very much for your hospitality, and I rather like Plymouth here. It'll be up in the Hoe, you know, the summer show. I said, oh, yes, and I went and had a look, sort of like a part of it tent and part of it sort of some sort of a wooden arrangement. It's rather peculiar.
Strange, yeah.
that was really it. And so we're coming back the next day. Marion said, well, there we are. We've just moved to Bognor. We've got a bit of a mortgage now. We can, it's marvellous. We can, and we had a young lad, Jonathan, was then about 2 years old, something like that, just over. She said, so it's marvellous. I said, well, I don't want to do it. She said, why not? I said, I've just a feeling. I don't know why I have. I said, oh dear, oh well, there we are. And so we sat in the garden at Bognor, I remember that summer, and she said, well, there you are, the phone hasn't rung. I said, no, but something will turn up. And so suddenly I got this phone call from a gentleman called David Croft. He said, Bill Pertwee, I've got your phone number from my agent. So I said, oh, yes. He said, well, we're doing a trial programme. It's a programme called The Fighting Tigers. And I've got a part for an air raid warden, only 2 lines, but I'd like you to come in on it. I said, oh, thank you very much. Said, how much do I get paid? He said, I think it's about £15. So I said, oh, well, yes, all right.
Good. Yeah.
Yes. And that was the start of Dad's Army. They did 6, having changed the name to Dad's Army instead of The Fighting Tigers, and so I did number 1 and number 6 in that
first series.
Yeah, because you know it suddenly started, and then after that, I rode into the whole lot.
And the history books, and also on the back of Dad's Army, you've probably got a lot more work.
It was amazing.
Mm.
It was, because not long after that started. I remember my agent then had become Anne Croft. And she was in Richard Stone's. She was, and she was the one who'd said to David originally, well, I've got somebody here, you're talking about the warden. I didn't know this till afterwards. She said, he's not an actor. So he said, I don't want an actor. He said, all I want is somebody to shout a lot and push people around. Well, she said, he's just the fellow. So that was engaged for that. And so after the first 6, it's suddenly, you know, I was in quite a lot of them.
You were written in, and also you had your own catchphrase as well.
Yes.
Which is quite something for a supporting actor.
Well, that's right, yes. I mean, although, looking back, I don't think I said put that light out more than 3 or 4 times.
I'm sure somebody would know how many times you said it.
Probably, yes. And so that's really it.
I mean, on top of your acting, you've written about 6 to 8 books.
Yes.
As well.
Mm. Yes, well, I'd been out after Dad's Army finished. I went out on tour with a couple of plays, one with Arthur Lowe, another with Molly Sugden, and I got quite good billing, you know, so forth. It was quite good. But then Richard Stone said to me, he said, there's another play coming up. He said, a comedy, but he said, I'm sorry, but they won't pay you much money, and your billing will be quite small. So I said, it means that I'm going downhill now then. So he said, well, you know, these things happen, but I'm sure something will come up for you. I said, all right. So I went back, and this was 19, I think, at the end of the 70s. Yes, it was the end of the 70s, after we'd, you know, Dad's Army had finished. And so I thought, well, I think I might start writing, which quite by chance this happened, because I then had an accountant in London. He said, do you like these? He said, you've done work at the seaside, haven't you? And he showed me four or five postcards of pierrots and things like that, you know. Oh, I said, that's marvellous, isn't it? They're lovely pictures. And I knew an old boy who'd been in the business in way back, and he was then managing the new theatre at Oxford. And anyway, I said, And suddenly I get a call from a company called Publishers David and Charles down at Newton Abbot. And they said, oh, we've just been talking to a joint accountant we have. So I said, oh, yes, we would like you to do a book about, obviously you're interested in pierrots and early summer shows and so forth. So I said, so I sat down and started writing this piece up. And Marion's parents, who'd been on the stage for donkey's years after they first met at Drury Lane, and they knew the business very well, you know, she said, I've got them to sort out a few sort of memories. And I said, well, I've also got this gentleman friend. He had a store of pictures and so forth. He said, oh, yes, you can have these.
Lucky, yeah.
Yes, yeah, that's no problem. I said, oh, fine. Really, that, and also people who I wrote round to local newspapers and things like this, asking whether people had got any memories or photos. And so I got tons of these, and I strung them together. Marion edited the book, and it was called Promenades and Pierrots. And it sold very well. I was absolutely astonished. But my brother said, I've written a book, it's going to be published. He said, what are you talking about? He says, you're an imbecile. He says, you'll ruin the name, family name. I said, there's twice this happened to me. Somebody has said that. But so that was the beginning. Then I did Royal Command.
Well, Royal Command, you followed up, and then you'd done the Dad's Army book.
Yes.
In 89.
That's right.
And you followed that with another one of your loves, The Station Now Standing.
Oh, yes,
your
yes.
Trains, which you, well, yes, was, yes. Railways is a love of yours as well.
Yes, it is.
And Stars in Battle Dress.
Yes.
Of course, your autobiography. And then another one going on from the promenade is By the Seaside.
That's right. Yes.
It's a book about seaside entertainment, which is another one of your
100 years of seaside entertainment, yes.
It's quite a collection of writing you've done over the years.
Yes, it's. I didn't know. In fact, you've reminded me that I did a softback of my autobiography that I did.
That's right, 1996.
Yes, right. Yes. My brother had died very suddenly, my other brother, and so I
put it all down on paper.
Yes, yeah. And so that was it, and that went out, and it did quite well.
Your book, Dad's Army, Making of a TV Legend, that one there, I think that book in itself is responsible for the resurgence of the popularity of the programme. That book alone, I think, because of you writing it, people's interest. There were no books on Dad's Army.
No.
Well, books about scripts and things.
Yes. Well, the funny thing was that I'd said to David and Jimmy, I think it's time there was a book written about the Dad's Army off screen.
The ins and outs.
Ins and outs and so forth. And they said, well, we haven't got time. I said, why don't you write it? So I got down to it, and that was that.
And that was, I mean, for myself, when I saw that book on the shelves, I couldn't believe it. At last, somebody's written something about Dad's Army.
Yes, it was quite amazing. I was surprised.
Well, it's from that the people wrote to you, obviously, in their, hundreds, I think, and asking about, is there a society on Dad's Army?
Yes.
And, of course, you collected all these letters together, and you kept them for a while, I believe.
Yes.
And he passed them on to a gentleman called Taj Muldoon, who then set up the Dad's Army Appreciation Society.
Taj, yes.
And of course he wrote to us, well, myself was one of them. And that's how it started, and since then it's snowballed, isn't it?
Yes.
And that's all because of your book, really.
It is quite amazing. You know, I've not done it from that point of view of I'm just going to write a book and I'll be... It's just that I was interested in it. So that was it. David Cross said, I mean, what gives you the idea to write certain things? I mean, you wanted to write the Dad's Army, that's fair enough, because we couldn't do it. I said, well, I'm just interested, so I'm not doing it. I'm delighted when it goes well, but the first thought is to actually write it, because it interests me.
And it's still great. It's on its third reincarnation, isn't it?
Yes.
And you told me earlier on today it's going for reprint again.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yes. I'm not sure when the second run of it, I'm not sure when that happened.
That was the 30th anniversary, so...
Ah.
It would have been about sort of 98.
Oh, yes,
sort of time.
yes, right. So then that's... And then, of course, did the one for Anova Books, which was the rewrite, which I had quite... It was quite a job to do that, because they'd given this very limited time to do
that's
it.
That's right, had to read it all and update every single bit of information, because a lot of people passed on, I suppose.
Well, it was, you see, yes. Mm. So, but hopefully it worked out all right. But I just think that one of the things... that Dad's Army has kept its popularity is because of the Dad's Army Appreciation Society to a great extent, because they push it around, as it were, if you know what I mean.
Make a nuisance of ourselves, I mean. Is that what you're saying?
Jack Wheeler started off Tadge, yes. And I don't know, I think that it's one of those things where people have, you know, friends, and I'm sure, I think that, I certainly know two people, because I heard, who'd written to the BBC, and that was directed to me on here. Nearly all of them that go to you are sent on to me, because they haven't got my address.
Oh, I see, fair enough, yeah.
Right, so I just think that the society, you know, have done quite a lot in the way of promoting.
It keeps in the public eye a bit,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes,
and of course that generates more sales, yes, and then generates, they, yes, put it on television again.
Yes. Yeah.
Which also helps you, and just keeps it going. Also,
yes,
you know, it's one of the highest ranking when it on Saturdays, for instance, it's one of,
yes,
the highest ranking programmes.
Yes,
still,
that's right, yes.
Which is amazing.
It's pretty amazing really, and as I say, I'm so astonished that from Little Acorns the society has grown to what it is now, which is marvellous.
Well, the society's got an excellent president, I think that's what it is. I can't remember his name. I think he played the warden. He used to shout a lot.
Yes.
He's the guy.
I remember having done one or two plays, which is marvellous, very early 70s, I think it was, and Ray Cooney, who... I got to know, of course. And so Richard said, oh, let me introduce you to Ray Cooney. And for a part in a new play he's got. Gave Ray Cooney my phone number, and he phoned up. And he said, oh, Bill, I've got to... Yes, there is this part. Can I send you a script? It's a sergeant. And so I said, yes. So he got it for me. And he said, read it, please, and let me have your... points of view. So that was, yes, I did it, but it wasn't a huge success. It did come into London, which is amazing. And called There Goes the Bride. I know that Marion came up to Thomas, and I said, I must take you outside, but let it get a bit dark first. That's it, before the play starts. And there was my name up in lights.
Oh, wow. Right.
So outside the Criterion, she said, oh, said Angel, you were just so... Well, I don't know. I mean, fancy having your name up in lights. He said, you're a theatrical spiff. You are, don't you know it? That was the start of a great friendship with Ray Cooney, and then went into another one of his plays, Run For Your Wife.
Run For Your Wife, very popular.
Yes, yeah. Yes, There Goes the Bride. We toured for about 6 weeks, and had a funny sort of set-up there, because Mona Cribbins was in that, and... Peggy Mount.
Oh, crap.
Peggy Mount, yes.
Famous Peggy Mount.
Peggy Mount. And they didn't get on together at all.
Oh.
No, they hardly talked. And they used to pass messages to me. I was the guy between us in my own. It just made me laugh. And that was, as I say, the first sort of introduction into the West End with this play, which was lovely. But I don't know. I didn't sort of take it too seriously. And when he was having... Ray used to do these marvellous things on the day before the dress rehearsal of doing about 3 hours of notes. And just even little tiny things. When you come through, they don't put your hand on...
Directions.
And I was lying on the floor and I dropped off to sleep, you see. Slightly snoring, apparently. So,
I'm sure you're taking it all in.
So Ray said, give him a kick. She said, it's her crib in Sydney. He said, way up there, wake up. I said, sorry, I must have dropped off. He said, yes, you did. So Ray said, oh, never mind, He said, what can you expect, Ray? He's not an actor. You can tell he's not an actor because he hasn't got any nerves. An actor should have nerves. Of course, he's not a proper actor, is he?
No. Pretty relaxed about it, wasn't he?
That was the start of it. And the follow-up to that was rather nice because they were doing another play and I went up to his office that he had this theatre of comedy at the Shaftesbury. He'd taken a lease on that. And I went to his office to give him a message, that was all, about somebody who wanted to get in touch with Ray. So I went to his office, which is just opposite. So I got up there, and I wasn't sure which door it was, so I walked along a corridor, and I heard these voices. And they'd obviously heard me and knew I was coming up. And the girl said, well, there's one part here that offered to Bill Pertwee, wouldn't you think? So they said, possibly, yes. He said, he's not a proper actor, but, I'm sure he's
nice.
I'm sure he'd be all right. I said, I can hear you. Bernard Cribb has always said, because he worked with him again.
Well, he's a good friend of yours, Bernard.
Oh, yeah, still. Absolutely, yeah. Yes. He used to greet me. When we were living in Surrey, he used to fish a lot, bring the fish up, put them on the lawn, on a sort of piece of wood he had, and cut the head off and the tail and all that sort of thing. Trout, he was a great trout fisherman. And he said, well, there we are. Oh, I only do it because you're not a proper actor.
I remember I went to see you once and you were complaining that another fish had turned up.
Yes. Oh, dear. What is poor wife?
So, you went on the stage for a while, then obviously your Rangmal had come up.
Yes.
On television.
Yes.
So, back on the TV again. So.
Yes. I had a thing about your Rangmal. I thought it was beautifully dressed. The costumes were lovely, the scenery was good, and I enjoyed playing the constable there. I literally just came in for the odd snack, as it were, or chat, or whatever. Made a lot of friends, but I really thought it was quality.
I think out of all the programmes they've done, Perrin Croft, I think that's the one that shines as the masterpiece, really.
David said that, I said, I really don't think this is so... He said, yes, I think it's the crown in our work.
I think it's only a shame it's never been repeated.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? And it goes out to...
Hungary, it's very big in Hungary.
Goes all over the place, isn't it? Yeah, it's amazing.
But it was a quality production. And
it was. Quality, yes. Absolutely.
And they dragged everybody in, didn't they, from all the other shows?
That's right.
In the end, you married...
Yes.
The cook?
Yes.
Poor old Brenda, who unfortunately passed away recently.
That's right, yes, yes.
But that was good.
Yes, it was good, yes. And Frank, of course, had met in Dad's Army. And then
you got Paul Shane and Jeffrey Holland and Sue.
Yes,
one.
He was a bishop, wasn't he?
He was a bishop, yeah.
Frank had become a bishop, I think, yes. I think so. And yes, and working with Sue and so forth. Is that, I remember that. Isn't it funny how you have no idea that something is going to become a catchphrase, but I remember there was I was sitting there as the policeman, and there was a chat going on between three, and one of them had lost the line, so there was this terrible pause. I looked and said, well, there you are then, and it got a laugh, and David said, isn't that amazing, afterwards.
And that was the name of the last programme, last episode was called Well, There You Are Then.
Yeah. Exactly. So he said, it's extraordinary, isn't it? I said, well, I just said something to sort of fill the gap. He said, and it became, they used to say, if conversations are going on when we're having a cup of tea or whatever it was, or a bit of lunch in the canteen, but somebody suddenly said, well, there you are then.
Yes, so, picked up on that.
Yes, it's strange business. So now, I'm mostly in the seasons, which is sort of end of October, November, December, I do after-dinner speeches.
Right.
Or if there's a special occasion, I'll do an after-lunch.
A bit of book signing here and there?
Well, exactly. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes. Just waiting to see whether they've said they were going to whether they have done a reprint, but I can't make it out.
No, I'm sure we'll find out plenty of time. Okay, Bill, thanks very much for talking to me and imparting some of your life history.
Pleasure.
It's always nice to see you and talk to you. And I wish you all every success with hopefully in a reprint of the book, and we're after dinner speaking.
Well, what a fantastic interview. I hope everyone at home enjoyed that. Thank you so much, Paul. And you know what? It was really lovely to hear memories of Bill Pertwee I hadn't heard before. And also hear that, I think Bill's 85 or 84, and he's sounding on fantastic form, It sounds really good. I'm very jealous. I did meet Bill very briefly at a do with Frank, and he was a very, very nice man, does a huge amount for charity. And in fact, I think it's on a previous podcast, the special one I did. So if you haven't heard that one, go, I think it was about 9 podcasts back, episode 41 maybe, where I did a Heritage Foundation do, and Bill Pertwee talks about his amazing charitable work. So that's another one to listen out for. But how about that, mate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's worth noting his charitable work. I seem to remember that's one of the reasons he received his MBE.
Yes.
I think, yeah. So absolutely fantastic interview. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Bill. Really good to hear.
And in January, we've got our feedback episode, which I can't wait for, because you've been sending in emails thick and fast to us. A lot of you following us on Twitter, which is brilliant. Keep it up. And if you enjoy it, we want to hear about your feedback about Bill. Mm. So please do send it in to the usual addresses. James@dadsarmypodcast.com or Oliver@dadsarmypodcast.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/dadsarmypodcast or twitter.com/Oliver Crocker.
Thank you very much. That was just done without any notes, whatever.
I need
fantastic.
I need that on a T-shirt.
We could probably get one of those,
yeah,
actually.
Why
yeah, why not? Anyway, I think the only thing that's really left for us to say is, oh, there are those sleigh bells
sleigh
again.
Bells. Can you
wonderful.
Hear me? Santa's on his way.
Oh, it's so Christmassy, it's snowy, it's wonderful.
It's absolutely brilliant. Well, what a wonderful year, mate. It's a pleasure coming on board the podcast and doing this with you, and it's a pleasure broadcasting all the latest Dad's Army news to you guys. So
absolutely.
Have a fantastic Christmas.
And we'll speak to you again in the new year. Bye for now.
Bye-bye. So who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler?
I'm glad I didn't ask you that. I never expected the pants one.
It's when I think of him, I think, I find it extraordinary that he did it.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Like going into the water,
He was lucky not to get pneumonia at some point, to be honest with you, because that poor actor was chucked into more rivers than, a fish.
Yeah.
Good luck to him. And wasn't it Wheels disease or something they were concerned about? You can't just chuck actors in rivers these days.
That's right.
Because of health and safety or something. But you look at Bill Pertwee, he's smoked all his life. He's been chucked in more rivers than, Duncan Goodhue. And he's done amazingly well. So anyway, and I'm still recording.
Are you really?
Well, right. Anyway, let's do the outro.
That's it.
So, okay.
That's the only problem recording in St. James's Park. We get extras.
Well, I've always wanted to record. I've always wanted to record lots of birds.
What's your favourite Hodges moment? I love the three oranges. Why is that? Good.
Go away. I'm going to go and get rid of them. Hang on a minute. Move off. Good. Oh dear. Thank you very much. Right, okay. Let's just go for this. All right, do you want to start?
Why not?
Go for it.
Okay.